This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton to adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is a true crime in real time update. The latest on the biggest cases we're following at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
It's not every day a murder trial kicks off with a clip from Jurassic Park playing in a New York courtroom. But that's exactly what happened during a recent hearing in the Rex Huerman case. Yes, that case. The one tied to the long, cold Gilgo Beach murders. Prosecutors, trying to explain how cutting-edge DNA science works, literally queued up a scene from the 1993 Spielberg classic where scientists extracted dinosaur DNA from ancient mosquitoes. As if to say, hey, Judge, if they can clone a T-Rex in Hollywood, surely we can match a strand of human hair to a suspect in real life. And just like that, we're in one of the strangest, most high-stakes scientific battles in a courtroom we've seen in years. Because at the heart of this particular moment isn't just whether the DNA from a hair is Huerman's or not. It's whether the science itself behind that match is even allowed to be used in front of a jury. This isn't courtroom theatrics for the sake of it. What's playing out here is a legal tug of war over how far forensic science can be pushed before it crosses into, well, science fiction. And in the Huerman case, the stakes couldn't be higher. So let's back up and set the scene. It's spring 2025. Rex Huerman, a Long Island architect, stands accused of being the man behind a string of murders that haunted Suffolk County for more than a decade. Seven women. Remains found along a stretch of desolate beach, a case long cold until his arrest brought it screaming back into the headlines. Now, with charges stacked against him, the pretrial phase is underway. And both sides are fighting hard over what evidence the jury will get to hear. At the center of it all, several strands of hair, no roots, no blood, no crime scene confession, just tiny rootless hairs found on or near the victims, some going back more than 20 years. The thing is, those hairs, though invisible to the eye and barely clinging to old duct tape or burlap, may carry the strongest forensic connection to Huerman. But only if the science used to analyze them is allowed into evidence. And that's what the current hearing is all about. It's called a Frye hearing, named after a nearly 100-year-old legal standard in New York that decides whether a scientific method is generally accepted by the relevant scientific community. Not just whether it works, but whether the community of experts who deal with this stuff every day says, yeah, this is legit. So far, the courtroom has turned into a crash course in molecular biology. And nobody's snoozing because what's being debated could very well determine whether a key piece of the state's case is even admissible. Let's talk about the method. Traditional DNA testing, the kind most of us have heard about from every true crime doc ever, usually relies on something called STR analysis. Think of it as checking a few dozen very specific markers in your DNA. But that process requires a decent quality sample, something with a root or a decent smear of biological material. The hairs collected in the Gilgo case didn't have that. No roots. Too degraded for conventional testing. So the investigators turned to a newer technique, whole genome sequencing. Instead of scanning a few genetic markers, this method looks at hundreds of thousands of them across your entire genome. It's like zooming way, way out to get a full map of the landscape instead of a street view. The lab that did this work is called Astria Forensics. They specialize in wringing DNA out of the kinds of samples that most labs would throw out. Hair shafts, old bones, evidence you'd think was long past its forensic expiration date. Using whole genome sequencing, Astria claims they were able to generate nuclear DNA profiles from those hairs, nuclear being the type of DNA that's unique to each person as opposed to mitochondrial, which just tells you the maternal line. And so what did they find? Well, one of those hairs allegedly matched DNA found on a discarded pizza crust from Huerman's trash. Others matched profiles consistent with his wife and daughter, suggesting indirect transfer from people inside his household. Prosecutors say these aren't vague connections. The probability of the hair belonging to someone other than Rex Huerman, in one case, was estimated at 1 in 10 to the 332nd power. That's a number so big it makes the lottery look like a coin toss. If that sounds like compelling evidence, it is, unless, of course, the court decides the science behind it isn't ready for prime time. Which brings us to the defense. Huerman's attorneys are not just poking at the results, they're going after the entire method. Michael Brown, leading the defense team, told the judge this was not science, calling it magic masquerading as evidence. He compared the technology to speculative guesswork, arguing that this whole genome sequencing approach has never been used in a New York criminal court. And they're right. This is the first time prosecutors in New York are asking to use this method in a criminal trial. The defense argues that whole genome sequencing may be acceptable in academic genetics or even in medical diagnostics, but that doesn't mean it's forensically validated. Different playing field, different rules. They also raised flags about Astria Forensics itself. The lab isn't accredited in New York. It's out of state for profit. The defense suggests this setup could create problems with chain of custody, oversight, or basic reliability. They argue that if you're going to use experimental science to accuse someone of multiple murders, the process should be bulletproof. Now, the prosecution isn't just sitting there. They've come to court with their own experts, and they're pushing back hard. Dr. Kelly Harris, a respected genome scientist, took the stand and made no bones about it. She called the technology not only reliable, but embarrassingly overdue in criminal forensics. She described the method as robust, powerful, and long accepted in scientific circles outside the courtroom. Then came Dr. Nicole Novrosky, a forensic genetics expert, and here's where that Jurassic Park moment happened. Novrosky played the iconic scene to illustrate that the public, and by extension juries, can grasp the concept of retrieving DNA from the past. Of course, nobody's trying to bring dinosaurs back, but they are trying to convince the court that if science can do that in theory, it can certainly extract usable DNA from a hair. Novrosky testified that nuclear DNA analysis in general has been accepted in forensics for decades. What's new is simply how much of the genome they're looking at now. In other words, the concept hasn't changed. The scope has. And she acknowledged that while the forensic community is still warming up to whole genome sequencing, the scientific foundation is already there. The state's message is clear. Just because something is new doesn't mean it's untrustworthy. Every forensic method, from fingerprinting to early DNA testing, was once new and untested in court. Someone has to go first. Now, the defense hammered back during cross-examination. They pointed out that while whole genome sequencing may be hot in genomics or research labs, its use in real-world criminal trials is extremely rare. Brown pushed Novrosky to admit that there's still a gap between general scientific acceptance and forensic acceptance. Basically, cool tool. But has it proven itself under pressure in a criminal case with someone's freedom on the line? And that right there is the question Judge Mazet now has to answer. Not whether the DNA belongs to Huerman. That's for a jury. His job is to decide whether the method used to obtain that DNA is legally sound. Is this a reliable scientific technique that jurors should be allowed to hear about? Or is it too experimental, too untested to risk influencing a trial? If the judge says yes, the DNA comes in. The prosecution gets to paint a picture of multiple victims, each allegedly linked to Huerman by microscopic strands of hair analyzed by technology that finally cracked the case. And if the judge says no, the prosecution loses a major piece of its puzzle. So far, no ruling has been issued. The Fry hearing is still ongoing, with more expert testimony expected in the coming weeks. But one thing's already clear. This case isn't just about a man accused of murder. It's about what kind of science we trust to decide guilt or innocence. And the courtroom isn't the only place where that question is being asked. As forensics evolves, the legal system has to decide when cutting edge becomes court ready. And this trial, or at least this motion, may very well set the precedent. Which brings us to a bigger question. Let's say this evidence does make it in. How exactly does it fit into the case? What do these hairs allegedly tell us about Rex Huerman and the women whose lives were stolen along the shores of Gilgo Beach? The Gilgo Beach murders were, for a long time, a wall of silence. Bodies scattered along an isolated stretch of Long Island coastline. Fragments of lives ended without answers. And a community haunted by the unknown. Investigators combed through marshland, sifted sand for bone and burlap, tracked cell towers and burner phones, but for over a decade, the case refused to break open. Then came the hairs. In 2022, when a new task force was formed to revisit the case, they didn't find a smoking gun or a dropped wallet. What they zeroed in on was trace evidence, minute, almost invisible strands of hair that had been sitting in storage for years. These hairs had been collected from the remains of several victims, carefully bagged, cataloged, and preserved by the original crime scene teams. No roots, no blood, just hair shafts, dry, degraded, and far too old for traditional forensic testing. At the time they were collected, they were little more than a maybe someday kind of clue. That someday finally arrived when Suffolk County authorities decided to send these samples to a California-based lab called Astrea Forensics. Astrea isn't your average crime lab. They're known for extracting DNA from samples that would make other labs throw in the towel. Think ancient bones, cremated remains, or hair without roots. It's kind of their thing. They use something called whole genome sequencing, a method that dives deep into the entire DNA blueprint, allowing scientists to work with incredibly small and damaged samples. In this case, Astrea was tasked with analyzing several rootless hair fragments recovered from at least four of the victims. These strands had been found on various surfaces, wrapped in burlap with the victims' remains stuck to duct tape, used in restraint, embedded in the fabric of clothing or bags. On their own, they didn't tell a story. But once processed and sequenced, they allegedly became a genetic thread, literally and figuratively connecting multiple victims to the suspect. The lab began by performing mitochondrial DNA analysis. This is a more established method, one used in forensic cases for decades. Mitochondrial DNA isn't unique to an individual. It gets passed down from mother to child, unchanged, through generations. It can't pinpoint a person the way nuclear DNA can, but it can narrow things down to a maternal line. In this case, mitochondrial testing of several hairs showed that they were consistent with the maternal DNA of Asa Ellerup, Rex Huerman's estranged wife. That might not sound dramatic at first, but it raised serious flags for investigators. These hairs weren't collected from the Huerman home or from their vehicle. They were found on the bodies of women last seen alive years before his arrest. If Ellerup's mitochondrial DNA was on victims who vanished long before the case reopened, that meant one of two things. Either she was involved or her DNA was transferred indirectly, passively, by someone close to her. Then came the nuclear DNA testing. This is the gold standard in forensic identification, the kind of testing that can, with staggering statistical precision, say whether a hair belongs to one specific person. Using whole genome sequencing, Astrea Forensics was able to extract nuclear DNA profiles from several of the hairs. According to prosecutors, the results pointed directly to Huerman. Let's break that down. And on one hair recovered from a burlap sack used to wrap one of the victims, the DNA profile matched Huerman with such specificity that the probability of it belonging to anyone else was calculated at 1 in 434, followed by 332 zeros. That's not a typo. That's the kind of number that feels made up until you realize it reflects the power of modern DNA analysis. Prosecutors say this is one of the strongest forensic connections in the case. Another hair recovered from a belt buckle found with a separate victim was consistent with nuclear DNA from Huerman's daughter. Again, not a direct accusation against her. There's no evidence she was involved. But just like her mother's mitochondrial profile, her nuclear DNA showing up on a victim suggests it may have been indirectly transferred through someone she lived with. At this point, investigators had a pattern. Multiple victims, multiple hair strands, multiple matches to individuals from inside Huerman's home. These weren't one-off coincidences. They were allegedly repeating across the evidence. And with each test, the narrative prosecutors were building grew stronger, that these hairs were not random, that they followed Huerman, that they lingered on his belongings, and that they ended up somehow on the remains of women found buried along the same desolate stretch of Long Island. And that's where the forensic story really starts to cohere. You don't need to know Huerman's online search history or the details of his burner phone activity to grasp the weight of the hair evidence. Because if these DNA links are accurate, they're not circumstantial. They're physical, tangible. The kind of thing that, if presented to a jury, can be shown under a microscope and measured in statistics so strong they defy common odds. That's what makes this DNA evidence such a linchpin in the case. Prosecutors aren't saying they found fingerprints on a weapon or a video of the suspect committing the murders. They're saying that in an otherwise circumstantial case, the DNA offers direct scientific association. Strands of hair that allegedly traveled with the killer and ended up with his victims. It's also important to note that the hairs weren't all found in the same place or in the same condition. Some were embedded in materials that had been exposed to the elements for years. Others were protected, wrapped inside the burlap or bags used to transport or conceal the victim's remains. The conditions varied, but the results were consistent. DNA pointing back to Huerman and those who shared a home with him. That's not to say the evidence is bulletproof. There are known challenges when working with degraded samples. Hairs exposed to the environment for years are vulnerable to contamination, DNA decay, and false negatives. The defense has already highlighted these risks, and they're likely to continue doing so. But what matters in this chapter of the case is that the technology has allowed forensic analysts to do something that was once impossible, make meaningful person-specific identifications from rootless hairs collected decades ago. It's not unlike developing old film in a new kind of dark room. The material was always there, but now the tools exist to bring it into focus. To the prosecution, this is the breakthrough moment. For years, the Gilgo case had been a swirl of clues without connective tissue. The DNA evidence, they argue, is the thread that ties it all together. Not just one victim to one suspect, but multiple victims to a single source. So they've gone as far as calling it a blueprint, a word that's more than just poetic when you consider that Huerman is an architect by trade. They say that the DNA shows not just contact, but method, a consistent forensic signature, not one lucky hair, but a trail, not one case, but many. And that's what makes this battle over admissibility so pivotal. Because if this DNA evidence survives the challenge in court, it won't just be allowed, it'll become the centerpiece. If it doesn't, the state loses its most direct physical link between the accused and the victims. But that legal fight is something we'll dig into next. Because while the science has been painstaking and the forensics meticulous, the real strategy is just beginning to show itself. When and how this evidence can be used and whether it should be allowed at all isn't just a technical matter. It's about what kind of trial this will be. One sweeping narrative or seven separate stories. And that's where the defense has made its next move. If you want to understand the stakes in the Rex Huerman case, you've got to stop thinking about it like just a murder trial. Because it's not just one trial, it's seven. Or maybe it's one trial about seven murders. Or maybe it's going to be seven separate trials, each with its own jury, its own story, its own chance to either convict or clear the accused. And that uncertainty? That's not a bug in the system. It's a strategy. It's courtroom chess. And right now, both sides are still deciding what pieces they get to move. Let's start with what we know for sure. Rex Hugerman, a former New York City architect, is facing charges in connection with the deaths of seven women. These aren't recent killings. They date back decades. The first victim he's accused of murdering, Sandra Costilla, was found in 1993. The most recent, Megan Waterman, was discovered in 2010. The remains were all found in or near Gilgo Beach, a desolate, windblown stretch of Long Island that became the center of a sprawling investigation once the bodies started turning up. Hewerman was arrested in July 2023. At first, the charges focused on three women, Melissa Barthelemy, Megan Waterman, and Amber Lynn Costello, all of whom were found wrapped in burlap in close proximity. These were dubbed the Gilgo Four, although only three were tied to Hewerman at the time of his arrest. Then, slowly, the charges expanded. Prosecutors added the case of Maureen Brainerd Barnes. Then came Jessica Taylor, then Valerie Mack, then Sandra Costilla. Seven in total. Each case brought with it new details, new forensic findings, and new layers of complexity. And with each added charge, the defense's task didn't just get harder, it got trickier. Because from a legal standpoint, trying one homicide is challenging enough. Trying seven at once, that's not just a trial. It's an avalanche of evidence, testimony, emotion, and narrative. And if you're the defense, that avalanche is exactly what you want to avoid. Which brings us to the second major motion they filed, a request to sever the charges. In plain terms, that means they want separate trials for each murder, or at the very least, for the group of cases to be split into smaller, more manageable bundles. The reasoning is pretty straightforward. If you try all the charges together, the risk is that the jury stops looking at the evidence case by case and starts forming one big picture, whether it's justified or not. The term lawyers use here is prejudicial. And it's not just a buzzword, it's a legitimate concern in multi-charge criminal trials. The idea is that even if a jury hears solid evidence in, say, two of the murders, they might start assuming guilt in the others just because the accused is already being painted as a serial offender. The individual facts of each case start to blur together. The danger isn't just that the jury gets overwhelmed, it's that they start connecting dots that don't legally connect. In the Hewerman case, this is especially sensitive because of the nature of the evidence. We're talking about forensic links, mostly hair DNA, and mostly circumstantial. The hair evidence allegedly connects Hewerman and people in his household to six of the seven victims. The defense argues that if all seven cases are heard together, the jury will see that pattern and assume guilt across the board, even if the evidence for some victims is thinner than for others. They're not saying the evidence shouldn't be heard. They're saying it shouldn't all be heard at once. The prosecution, unsurprisingly, sees it differently. They've made it clear that they believe the cases are deeply interrelated. The victims were all women, mostly sex workers, all found in or near the same area, with similarities in how their bodies were concealed. Prosecutors argue this isn't seven separate crimes. It's one extended pattern, one modus operandi, committed by one man. In their view, the hair evidence doesn't just support that theory, it helps prove it. But here's where things get more nuanced. Just because something feels connected doesn't mean it legally counts as connected enough to try together. There's a balancing act at play. Courts have to weigh the efficiency of trying multiple charges at once against the defendant's right to a fair trial. And if the court decides that trying all seven cases together would unfairly prejudice the jury, it can order them to be separated. This is where the Frye hearing, remember, the one about the DNA evidence, starts to intersect with the severance motion. Because if the DNA evidence is thrown out, the cases become more isolated. The threads connecting them start to fray. On the other hand, if the DNA is allowed in, the prosecution can argue that there's a clear forensic through line that justifies trying all the cases as one. That's why the defense has been attacking the DNA so aggressively. It's not just about the science, it's about the structure of the trial. If they can get the DNA excluded, they not only weaken the prosecution's evidence, they also strengthen their case for severance. And they're not exactly being subtle about it. Defense attorney Michael Brown has hammered this point in court. that allowing the jury to hear about hair DNA from six victims in a single trial would be massively prejudicial. Even if the DNA itself was reliable, something the defense clearly disputes, its cumulative impact could overwhelm the jury's ability to evaluate each charge individually. There's another layer to this, too, how juries respond to volume. It's one thing to hear that someone might be responsible for a single murder. It's another to sit through weeks of testimony and see the same defendant's name come up again and again. Even if the cases are being presented separately within the same trial, the psychological effect is powerful. That repetition can act like reinforcement, subtle, subconscious, and very difficult to compartmentalize, and the defense knows this. They're arguing that the fairest way forward is to break the charges apart, let each case be judged on its own merits, let the evidence stand or fall without being propped up by other cases that may or may not be as strong. From their perspective, trying all seven together doesn't just tip the scales, it breaks them. But for the prosecution, severance is a logistical nightmare. Seven trials means seven jury selections, seven openings, seven closings, seven verdicts. It's costly, it's time-consuming, and it increases the chance of inconsistent outcomes. And from their standpoint, the whole point of the case is that these crimes are part of a pattern they say Huerman fits. If the evidence across cases helps prove that pattern, splitting the trials up would dilute their strongest argument. Right now, both motions, the one about the DNA evidence and the one about severance, are sitting with the judge. No rulings yet. But everyone in that courtroom knows that the decisions will shape the rest of the case. If the DNA comes in and the cases stay joined, the prosecution has a narrative arc. Seven women, one suspect, one trial. If the DNA is excluded and the cases are split, the defense gets to chip away at the charges one by one. It's not just about facts anymore. It's about format. And that's what makes this stage of the case so important. Because the way this trial is structured, how the evidence is grouped, how the charges are presented, will define what the jury hears and how they interpret it. The courtroom isn't just a venue for deciding guilt or innocence. It's a battlefield where every rule, every motion, every decision can shift the momentum. And right now, those decisions are still on the table.
He was charming. Handsome, a devoted husband, a doting father. When his wife died tragically in a freak accident, everyone pitied him. He played the role so well, grieving widower, devastated, single dad, just trying to put the pieces back together. But the thing about perfect men, they're usually hiding something. And this one was hiding everything. The affair. The insurance policy. The other wife in another state who had no idea she was married to a walking crime scene. If she had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, she could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free. And before everyone else, she could have seen through the lies. She could have gotten out while she still had the chance. Instead, she's just another case we'll be covering next week. Don't be her. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.